Welcome to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. We introduce you to the voices of community thought leaders and change makers who are working on solutions that face our fellow individual community members, neighborhoods, cities, and our region. This is George Koster, your host. This episode is part of our series exploring COVID-19's impact on nonprofits and small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area. Back in April of 2020, when we decided to create this ongoing series on COVID-19's impact, first on nonprofits and then on small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area, we, like you, had no idea how long the pandemic would go on and what the health and economic impact would be in our community. As we enter the second half of 2022 with the latest explosion of cases from the most recent COVID-19 Omicron mutations, along with the masking requirements being changed and folks getting their vaccinations, our communities are still struggling to deal with the health, economic, mental, and societal impacts of the ongoing global pandemic. This all adds to the ongoing uncertainty of our ever-changing indoor and outdoor, vaccinated and unvaccinated protocols, and the politics of the pandemic that will drive how we all come back together as a unified or fractured community. We will continue to shine a spotlight on the nonprofits and small businesses that make up the fabric of our community, along with the founders and staff who are struggling to deal with the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on their operations, services, and sustainability until we can all get to the other side of the pandemic. Along the way, we will also share with you all the amazing solutions that our nonprofits, small businesses, foundations, and government leaders are working on to help us all get to the other side of the pandemic and come together to rebuild our communities with more economic, social, and environmental equality.
In the course of the pandemic, Congress actually passed three different stimulus payments to help families stay afloat in a time when they were being asked to stay home from work, which was great. I think that was one of the best things that the government could have done, and they did it because that's when people needed that help. But there were millions of people that were excluded just because of their immigration status. While at the same time, there were essential workers that were actually required. Some of them were required to actually show up to work and be exposed to coronavirus at a time when we didn't have a vaccine.
Good morning, everyone. I'm George Koster, your host, and we want to thank you for participating in our virtual live recording of another one of our one-hour radio show specials. Our show today focuses on the community-centered financial services work of Mission Asset Fund. Our guests for today's show are the co-founder of Mission Asset Fund, Jose Quinones, along with the director of programs, Ilana Fairley, and the manager of financial education and engagement, Efrain Segundo. Welcome to Voices of the Community, Jose, Elena, and Efrain.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'd like to start by asking each of you to just provide the audience just a brief background on yourself and your role at Mission Asset Fund.
I guess I'll start. I'm the founding CEO of the Mission Asset Fund. Started the organization back in 2007, I think, maybe eight. I grew up in San Jose, born in Mexico, and I've always dedicated my career to helping low-income immigrants, whether it being from policy advocacy, working in D.C., working for a member of Congress, or organizing different campaigns at the student level or at the community level. I've always worked for community, and I'm very happy and privileged to be working with MAF for the past 15 years and trying to help people build their financial security.
Thank you. And Efrain, would you like to start next?
Sure thing. Thank you for having us. My name is Efrain Segundo. I'm the financial education and engagement manager at MAF. I've been lucky to be at MAF for 3 years, going on four, had a couple of different roles here. And my career has been completely in nonprofit and just being able to connect with community, especially around finances and showing how much of a pillar that is in just anybody's life and how transferable those skills are to other facets of life. So just really happy to be such an awesome organization. We're really innovative in the way we do things, and just yeah, I'm surrounded by awesome people, as you're going to find out from Jose and Elena, and I'll pass it off to Elena.
Thanks, Efrain, and good morning. My name is Elena Fairley. I'm the programs director at MAF. I've had the honor of working at MAF for the last 7 years. My role is really to oversee our programs that help people become visible, active, and successful in their financial lives, including lending circles, immigration loans, business microloans, and even cash assistance. So very similar to Efrain, and Jose, my career has been all about creating economic equity, creating a world where everyone has the opportunity to reach their full potential, and really happy to be here today and talk about our work.
Thank you. And I'd like to turn back to you, Jose, and if you could provide the audience just kind of the origin story of MAF.
Yeah, thank you for that question. The Mission Asset Fund, we started our work back in 2007. It was after the Levi Strauss Company, I think maybe like the last functioning factories in the U.S. actually making Levi jeans at that time. And so the company decided to close that building down in 2005. But what they wanted to do is to basically close it down. They sold the building, and then they wanted to reinvest some of the proceeds back into the community. And so through a lot of engagement, a lot of conversation over the course of a couple of years, community leaders came together and said, we need to organize a new organization, a new nonprofit that could focus on the issues of asset building, financial empowerment, financial education. And so when the opportunity came up, I just jumped at it because I thought I couldn't remember the last time or if ever where I had heard that a foundation, in this case, the Levi Strauss Foundation, was putting up in $1 million at that time to start a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping low-income immigrants improve their financial security. I mean, to me, it's like I had never heard of that. It happened. And so I was really committed to making sure that we were going to be successful in that enterprise, because I didn't want for that to be another sign of failure in an effort of trying to improve people's lives in that community level. And so that's how we started. And from that, we were able to innovate so that we can demonstrate what could work at the national level.
Well, and I think just kind of staying with that, if you could provide some context or, if you will, framing around the conversation that we're going to have today about the need for Mission Asset Fund's value proposition or services. And I think piece that you talk about in your own mission and about Mission Asset Fund is the financial invisibility of literally millions of people in the United States. So could you kind of share with the audience a little bit about what you mean by financial invisibility, how that impacts folks, and then for anyone who's been spending any time with regards to finance and our underserved communities, there's an entire community of what, around 9 to 11 million unbanked people in the United States. So I think kind of providing some context around that, and then we can turn to Elena to tell us and Efrain to tell us more about programs.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we kind of got into this work not really even understanding what that term was. I don't think we had that term about being financially invisible or even being credit invisible. At the time, that wasn't a term. And I think from our perspective, we basically looked at the mission, which was, how do you help low-income immigrants improve the financial security when, in fact, half of the people that we were targeting to help didn't have a checking account or savings account? At that time, there was a study that came out that basically found that 44% of mission households did not have a credit score, or their file was so thin that they couldn't generate a credit score. So to me, the question was, well, how do you help people build financial security when they don't have even access to the most basic of tools, like a checking account or a credit score or credit history, for them to build their financial lives? How do you do that? At that moment in time, the conventional wisdom was that, well, all we needed to do is provide people with more financial literacy, get them in a classroom, teach them how to balance a checkbook, and maybe they'll take notes and then that'll be it. I mean, that was convention. But at the time, we knew that that wasn't going to be enough. We knew that we needed to do more and provide something that was actually going to be real and tangible and practical to actually help their improve their financial lives in a tangible and intangible ways. And so for us, even before understanding the term credit invisibility, we knew that credit, however, was going to be really an important component of that. And so we, in the asset building world, in the financial empowerment world, credit wasn't even a topic of conversation, frankly. But so we were able to sort of push that idea through and now have made that an issue of concern. But at that moment, we're thinking about, well, how do you do that? How do you help people improve their financial lives when they don't have the basic access? Well, then you have to help them create that access. And so we were able to sort of use that as a starting point to innovate on how to make that happen. And so that's how we then figured out, well, it's not that people didn't have access to credit, because they were actually creating their own credit. And so we had to figure out how to recognize that and use that as a starting point for innovation. So once we realized that that wasn't just a case, you know, in folks in the Mission or folks in San Francisco, but that was like a national problem. As you noted, there's like 7-8 million people that are unbanked, has consistently been at that level for a long time. I mean, there's about 26 to 30 million people that are considered credit invisible. Again, that's been a persistent problem across the country. Then we were able to realize that through our work, we were able to sort of impact a bigger issue that went beyond the Mission District.
Thank you. It's really, really good table setting, if you will. So I'm going to turn to you, Elena, and ask you to share with the audience. And there's so many wonderful programs that MAF provides. I don't want to get us into all of the granular detail, if you will, but you have a whole concept called community-centered approach. So let's start there and kind of go into the programs. And then I want to turn to Efrain and talk about education and outreach and how you use technology.
Well, thank you, George, for highlighting our community-centered approach. And that's really where we like to start when we talk about our programs, because it is really the foundation for everything that we do. It informs our work from the smallest client interaction to our vision for change. So this community-centered approach can be summarized with just four words: engage, build, scale, and mobilize. And to break this down, what this means is that first and foremost, we engage deeply with communities to really understand clients' real lived experience and context. And I think that came through very clearly in Jose's retelling of our founding story. We trust that clients are the experts of their own lives, and we seek to listen to them. Next, we build. So we build on clients' innovative practices and strategies. We know that our clients are already actively participating in their financial lives. And so instead of thinking about, oh, what needs to be fixed? What's broken? Instead, we want to really shine a spotlight on what's really good in people's lives and seek to elevate that and build on that. The third part of our approach is that we scale our programs using the best of finance and technology. So we're a very tech-forward organization. We see this as a really important lever in bringing our programs to more communities, and also doing so in a really accessible and dignified way. And then the fourth part of our approach is mobilize. So we mobilize to use our deep learnings and insights to advocate and to organize for systemic change. And we do this because we want to create a fair financial marketplace that really works for everyone. So with this context of how we do this work, how we engage communities, bringing this down to earth a little bit and providing an example of what this actually looks like, I think a great example is our Lending Circles program. This is really our signature program. We've been offering Lending Circles since the very beginning. And for those of you who are not familiar, Lending Circles really at its core is a common global tradition of communities coming together and lending and borrowing money with one another. So it goes by many different names. Those listeners from Mexico may know this as a tanda. Listeners from the Philippines may know this as a palawagan. There's many names that this goes by. And many immigrant communities across the Bay Area and beyond participate regularly. And just to provide a very brief example of what this looks like, say you have 10 people, 10 community members coming together. They each agree to contribute $100 per month into a collective pool. That first month, one person in the group will get their turn to receive that lump sum of $1,000. And then the next month, that'll continue. And the next person in line will get to receive that lump sum of $1,000. And this will continue in this way until every single person gets a turn to essentially receive that lump sum of those contributions. And so what we've done is we have formalize that process. We've created a program that is recognized, that is visible, and we've added credit reporting. So I think this goes back directly to Jose's vision for our founding. We knew that credit was so important, and we knew that community members were already engaging in all this bona fide financial activity. So how could we just simply elevate that and give people credit for what they were already doing in their lives? So fast forward many years, we've grown our Lending Circles program. It's become just a signature part of our work in San Francisco and beyond. We've also brought Lending Circles to more communities.
And to just end the Lending Circle component for folks who, I mean, Lending Circles at its basic core is any of us in the Zoom room at this moment could participate in Lending Circle. It's people in the community basically showing up with whatever they have available to lend into the circle, and those pools of funds can be accessed by community members.
That's exactly right. It's all about communities showing up for one another, community members supporting one another, and it's really a beautiful thing.
And just to get a little bit more granular, when you say you've tied it into credit building, share with the audience how folks who repay money that they borrowed from a lending circle actually gets tied into one of the credit bureaus so that that person is able to actually begin or rebuild credit.
Absolutely. So as you can imagine, many of the folks who come to us don't actually have any credit history whatsoever. They're, as we described earlier, they're credit invisible. That is absolutely not a barrier to participating in a lending circle with us. We welcome folks who are just starting out in their credit journey. And by joining a lending circle with us, they actually sign a formal loan agreement with us. And that loan agreement is what enables us to report all of those monthly payments that I described, all of those contributions that they're making into their lending circle to the three major credit bureaus. And in that way, every single month they're participating, they're getting recognized as having on-time payments. And through this approach, we're seeing that many thousands of people have been able to actually establish their first credit score through participating in programs with us.
That's wonderful. And then you also have business programs, because so many of our immigrant entrepreneurs that make up really the fabric of what I would consider to be community economic development, all of the commercial corridors like 24th Street or 16th Street in the Mission, for example. Talk a little bit about how someone who's a micro entrepreneur, for example, can work with MAF to help bring their dream to life, or if they've already got a going business, what else can they access in the way of funds?
So we work with a very entrepreneurial community. We have looked at our data and we've seen that almost a third of our clients across the board are entrepreneurs in one sense or another. So we knew early on that we had to really cater our programming to support that community of small business owners. And so we created a special zero interest loan just for these very small business owners that oftentimes may be self-employed, may just be working for themselves starting off. We really think about these folks as nano businesses that are operating with small, local, and sometimes even informal businesses. So we're able to offer folks a zero interest business microloan of up to $2,500. And what I think is really phenomenal about this program is that we offer this to folks who are just starting off, who might not necessarily have a profit and loss statement that they would be required to have really with any other lender. And in this way, this is their first entry point into the financial market, into getting accessing business capital. They can participate in our business microloan with us, get a zero interest loan to help them buy inventory, just get going, get their website up, get their footing, and build credit and move on to ultimately accessing larger pools of business capital as their business grows. And as you said, just be in a really core part of the fabric of our community.
And so if I was someone who is in the audience and is interested in participating in a lending circle, and also if I was a, what I like to call hobbypreneur, or someone who has a passion about creating their favorite food, could be salsa, could be starting a restaurant, a food cart, or it could be creating whatever craft they have, they're a maker, how would they get engaged with MAF? What's the process for folks to actually either help lend money or go in and become a micro borrower?
I love that question. And I hope that there are listeners out there right now who are just waiting to start that salsa business or start that food cart. The best thing to do is go to our website. Our website is missionassetsfund.org. All of our programs are listed on our website. You can find our Lending Circles program, our Business Microloan program, and more. Read about the program, and you can even apply online. So I would absolutely encourage folks to go to our website. And just once more, that's missionassetfund.org.
Thank you. And turning to Efren, your focus is on education and community outreach. And Jose talked a lot about basically meeting people where they're at, et cetera, and listening to the community. Can you share with us just your work and effort on essentially providing financial education for folks who have not had any in the past? And then I'd like to also dive down a little bit deeper on the whole use of technology and the MAF app. So let's start with how you do outreach and financial education.
Yeah, definitely. The financial education journey at MAF has been a pretty cool one, actually, because it started at a very small scale and it's evolved to something on a national level and something that we're really proud of and something that I would consider, if you ask me, one of the pillars of MAF now because of just the outreach and the amount of scope that we have. So financial education started because in order to participate in one of our lending circle programs, we make it a requirement that every participant has to interact with some sort of financial education that we provide. And that was in the form of a FinEd portal. And that FinEd portal, people could log on and they would go on there and they would pick whatever topic they want to learn about. And we say 100% of our participants participate in at least an hour of financial education prior to joining a Lending Circle. So immediate interaction right there. And then it came about, I actually got hired at MAF as a financial coach. And we had a partnership with the Ventanilla de Asesoría Financiera. And these were at the Mexican consulates in the Bay Area in San Jose and San Francisco. So MAF had two financial coaches, one at each site, that would provide financial coaching to people visiting the Mexican consulates. So people would come in and say, hey, Efrain, I'm really interested in starting my credit, but I'm an immigrant and I don't have a social security number. How can I do so? So we would coach them through a process, give them their options. But most of the time it would stop there because the consulate was like the DMV. Unless you need to go there, like you don't really go there or go back, right? So then we realized, hey, we need to engage these participants, these people even more, because we have people coming through our door. We know people are interested. So how can we do so? Then what happened? The pandemic struck and less people were going to these consulates. And MAF realized, hey, we need to do something. So what did we do? We say, hey, at the consulates, we used to have what was called mini charlas. I would go out there and I would stand in the waiting room and I would give a quick 10-minute pitch about a topic. I would say, hey, like, are you interested in learning about credit? I would give you the quick little elevator pitch. Boom, 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 boom. Like, come by to my office. I got a flyer for you. I got some resources for you and I can help you out. Right. So we said, hey, we're going to magnify this even larger and make them into actual charlas. And we started doing this on Facebook Live because we say, hey, you know what? The community is on social media. So what better way, what easier way to give them access than to put it on social media so they can get connected with MAF? Hopefully we can connect them with more resources or more information that they're interested in. So we started hosting these charlas, and these charlas, when we started them, they were like 30 minutes. And we were covering core topics that at that time, it was just the financial coaching team at MAF that was in charge of them. It was a team of three of us. And we would knock out these charlas and we started seeing really, really good traction, really good attention from the community. They started suggesting topics that they would be interested in learning from. So we started building this really cool library of different topics that you could still find on our Facebook. To be honest, feel free to scroll back a year and you'll see like how far we've come. And to go on to your question about technology, one of the really cool things that I love about working at MAF is that we're super innovative, right? We're doing things that I really don't see anybody else doing. And a prime example of that is this entire time, we've also had our own mobile app, right? Because I think one of the key things that you're going to hear, key themes today, is access. We want to create access and we want to make it as easy as possible for people to just have access to the information they're looking for, the resources that could help them. And even more importantly, the community around them that's like willing to support and to share. So we have an app. It's called the MyMath app. I highly encourage anybody listening to check it out because it's a really cool app. I like to pitch it as having a financial coach in your pocket at all times. So if you're interested in learning about a topic like credit, like debt, how to start your own business, how to build a savings plan, we offer modules that we create in-house right there within the app. Really, really cool thing that I love about the app that I think we do really well is that we offer in English and in Spanish. And the Spanish is really good. It's not like translator Spanish. It's like written in Spanish with the intention of a Spanish speaker reading it and being like, man, this was written for me to read. So highly encourage you, check out the app, especially if anybody listening here is going to start a lending circle. We have some really cool features that are available to you if you join a lending circle and you download the app. So as far as technology, we use that. And we have some really cool things in the works that I don't really want to open up about right now, but we're going to take the way that we leverage technology to a whole new level really soon. So maybe the next time you have us back, I could tell you a little bit more about that.
You're listening to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. Voices of the Community is supported by a grant from the James Irvine Foundation, dedicated to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. More at irvine.org. This is George Koster, your host, and if you're just joining us, in this episode, we're discussing how providing financial services changes lives with the co-founder and CEO, Jose Quinones, along with the director of programs, Elena Fairley, and the manager of financial education and engagement, Efrain Segundo, from the Mission Asset Fund. Let's get back to our conversation about their work to provide financial education, financial services, and a universal basic income to thousands of families in the San Francisco Bay Area and across the nation.
Well, and staying with the technology component of it, the coaching, right? I mean, you're talking about being in person at the consulates. I love that story. I can only imagine everyone looking at each other like, who's this guy? But the whole idea of reaching folks and making it easy for folks to lower that barrier entry is to have the financial coaching online. And I noticed that you have modules on, to your point, how to buy a car. But can you share a little bit about the actual online coaching component itself? Because you're hosting, you just had a session yesterday, for example. So both in Spanish and English.
Yeah, definitely. So that was one thing too that we wanted to try our best to recreate. I personally, like, I'm an extrovert. I love being in front of people and connecting with you face to face and shaking your hand. It was really hard to recreate that on like online, right? But we managed to do that. We have an awesome team of financial coaches. Shout out to Liliana, Alex, and Susana, because they do a fantastic job of connecting with community. They do so on an online platform. So we offer various methods, George. One, we do Zoom just like this. And one thing that we found is that a lot of people, once the pandemic started, managed to or had to learn how to use Zoom. For example, like for their kids' meetings at school, you had to download Zoom on your phone because that was the way you had to talk to the teacher, the administrators. So we made the shift from Facebook Live, and we also added Zoom because we know, hey, a lot of the community members are already using it. So you can receive financial coaching one-on-one for an hour completely free with us over a Zoom session or a phone call, because we don't want to leave out those folk who aren't using Zoom, who simply want to pick up a phone and call somebody. And you know what? We don't get to look them in the eye when we're providing that service, but the message is still delivered and the conversations are still profound. So we make it really easy for anybody to go ahead and access our financial coaching. In case anybody's listening is interested, you can visit our website, missionassetfund.org. There's a tab that says financial services, and you can schedule the next available appointment with any of our financial coaches, and they'll give you a call. And you could talk about anything that you'd like about your finances. It could be a 10-minute conversation if that's all you need. It could be an hour. It could be multiple hours if you want to keep coming back. And we encourage you to keep coming back. If we can help you resolve all your financial questions in one session, that's awesome. But we're not going to say, hey, don't come back. We're going to encourage you to come back, even if it's years from now, and let you know that this is a resource that's here to stay.
Thank you. I want to turn back to Jose to just kind of provide a global perspective of how COVID-19 has impacted MAF's work over this last 2+ years. And then we'll go back to Elena to talk a little bit about how you responded in the creation of programs.
Yeah, COVID definitely turned everything upside down. The past 2.5 years have been a shock for the country, but even more so for people that we now call essential workers. I think from what you've heard from Elena and Efrain about the depthness of our engagement with people in being in real conversation about their financial lives and really us showing up and trying to be relevant in their lives, I think that's really what led us to the work throughout the pandemic. One of the things we realized almost immediately after the San Francisco mayor issued the stay-at-home order, if you might remember back in March of 2020, where we knew that right away that people were going to lose income, because for our folks to stay at home means that they cannot work. And if they cannot work, they cannot earn wages. And if they can't earn wages, they're not going to be able to pay the rent. And so while we have lending circles and other products available to help them build a credit, at that given moment, we knew that what people needed was going to be cash. And so we right away instituted a new program that we called Rapid Response Fund to basically fundraise to try to get people money quickly. And in that, we started that fund with zero money in the bank. But very quickly, we had funders, we had other corporations, we had other philanthropists reaching out to us to try to use our platform and our engagement with people to try to get them direct money. One of the things we realized soon enough, too, was that because of the folks that we work with, we had an inkling that, that they were going to be left out from any federal sort of response in helping people, weather that pandemic. And that actually happened. I mean, in the course of the pandemic, Congress actually passed 3 different stimulus payments to help families stay afloat and in a time when they were being asked to stay home from work, which was great. I think that was one of the best things that the government could have done, and they did it because that's when people needed that help. But there were millions of people that were excluded just because of their immigration status. While at the same time, there were essential workers that were actually required. Some of them were required to actually show up to work and be exposed to coronavirus at a time when we didn't have a vaccine. And so people were dealing with a lot and also not receiving any help from the federal or state government. So what we did, you know, was very quickly expanded the Rapid Response Fund in a way to help people in the smallest way possible, but more importantly, to kind of show up to say, like, say, hey, we see you. We understand that you're being excluded, but here's some help, even though it might be small, but here's some help. And that effort turned out to be more important for us than ever, because we were able to kind of send people what I called in a message of hope and love, saying that we are engaged, that we're here with them in community through these difficult times. And in the course of that campaign, I mean, we were able to raise close to $100 million, frankly, from different foundations, different corporations. Even McKinsey Scott came in to support the work of MAV during that campaign with a grant of $45 million. And then we were able to sort of use that money and very quickly deploy it through our rapid response to emergency loans, or even now what we're doing with our recovery program through more of a UBI type of an effort. And so we were able to sort of use that as a way to, you know, raise more funds, but also to try to show up in the way that we knew that really mattered to people's lives. So it transformed us. It transformed MAV quite significantly. And so now we're in a different situation because of it. And we're trying to manage the growth now that we've had, because now we're at a national level, doing everything at scale. We're working with community members across the country, not just in San Francisco. And so the question is like, well, how does that change our approach? It is a question. For us, being rooted in the mission is really important, because that being rooted in community kind of informs the way we show up at the national level as well.
Thank you. That was a good overview. And I want to come to you, Elena, and have you share with the audience more about the Immigrant Families Recovery Program that Jose has kind of set up for us. And then I think a follow-on to that would be, how can someone who's listening or know someone who would need access to the Universal Basic Income Plus program, how do they get engaged?
Absolutely. So our Immigrant Families Recovery Program is one of our newest programs, and it is a program that's a first of the kind in the nation. It is supporting immigrant families who continue to be excluded from federal relief. And we're doing this through cash assistance. So qualifying families receive $400 per month for up to 2 years. This is no strings attached. We believe, as we mentioned, that people are the experts in their own financial lives. So we haven't set any stipulations in the usage. And alongside this monthly cash assistance, families can also select financial services, like the financial services you heard from Efrain, that work best for them, including the one-on-one coaching, financial education, and group workshops. So we're really excited about this work for a number of different reasons. I think there's a large conversation going on about guaranteed income in the country right now, and we're really excited to be able to share the insights that we learn from this really targeted program supporting immigrants. And one of the things that we're also really excited about is we're also applying a self-advocacy lens to this work, which is really new and exciting. And if I can, I would love to just pass it to Efrain to say a little bit about how we're integrating this concept of self-advocacy training into this work.
Yeah, definitely. I would love to. So as you see, we're trying to offer not only aid in monetary support, but we're trying to provide aid and hey, here's some offerings around financial education in case you need some suggestions or just some guidance into how you want to maneuver this new situation that you're going through, right? But we do all of that with the lens of self-advocacy. So we define self-advocacy as somebody being able to do something for themselves, right? And a lot of our talleres, for example, I talked about our taller around how to read a credit report. So we define that as a financial muscle, because reading a credit report is a specific document, specific skill. Same thing with filing a credit dispute, right? once you learn that process, it becomes much easier. Next time it happens, it's almost like clockwork. That's somebody learning a new financial muscle and flexing it whenever necessary. But we're doing it with the intention of not just having people learn how to read a credit report. We want people to be able to transfer that skill set into something in their civic lives, right? So we try to make sure that all of our focus and our efforts are intended to do that, not just give somebody a fish for a day, but give them the rod and show them where the lake is so they can fish for the rest of their lives. Something along those lines.
Nice metaphor. Elaine, I want to go back to you because this wasn't an easy program to create. I mean, everyone, and there are, for folks listening, we did a documentary on Stockton and Michael Tubbs' first pilot program in Stockton with a UBI. And so it's wonderful to see that folks are trying to execute UBIs in the state of California and even across the country. But it's a really complex process of doing that because on the other side, there's people like, oh, you're just giving folks money, you're giving it away, et cetera. Can you share with us just how you put the structure together? You had like 9 different partnerships, how folks, I hate to use the term qualify, but how folks actually are able to access the universal basic income.
You're exactly right, George. These programs are much more complicated to deliver and deliver well than you might imagine. You might think on first glance that giving away money is relatively easy, but when you think about doing that thoughtfully, equitably, in a dignified way, It's actually quite complex. And so one thing that I would say is just to back up a little, the UBI program that we're talking about really grew out of that original COVID-19 rapid response effort that Jose described. So we provided one-time cash assistance in this moment of need, in this crisis, in this pandemic, to over 65,000 people nationally. And really coming out of that work, we started thinking about how do we create more ongoing sustained supports? And that was really the conversation that led us to our UBI program, our Immigrant Families Recovery Program. But if I can, I would love to tell the story of just how we initially planted the seed for this work in San Francisco, as you mentioned, through partnerships. So to do that, I have to take us all the way back to March of 2020, when San Francisco's first shelter-in-place order was instituted. As Jose described, he started running a million miles an hour fundraising to be able to bring in the funds to support this work. And in a parallel way, myself and others at MAF started running a million miles an hour organizing the structure of this campaign and working on implementing and creating an infrastructure to get these funds out the door. And after that, the word spread like wildfire. And we saw Facebook groups popping up where friends and family were helping each other apply, helping, saying like, this is real, you can trust MAF. They helped me, I'm participating in their charlas, I'm engaged. And they became really our ambassadors and our leaders to help us get the word out and really to build trust in a time when trust was one of the most important commodities that we had. When there was so much fear and uncertainty, trust really meant everything. And I think this is really a story of really relying heavily on your partners to be able to extend that circle of trust.
And you had around, what, 6,000 people in San Francisco alone, I think it was?
That's exactly right. So through this work, we were able to deliver cash assistance to nearly 6,000 San Franciscans. This was a huge part of our national relief efforts. And that amounted to almost $3 million that went directly to immigrant families to help support them with paying their next month's rent, putting food on the table, really serving as that bridge and that lifeline during a moment of crisis.
Thank you. And Jose, I'd like to turn to you and have you share a little bit about how the program obviously started in San Francisco, but now MAF's actually, you've been able to scale up this program into San Mateo County and what that looks like and what the impact in San Mateo County has been.
Well, I mean, it's definitely a national program, right? So ultimately, we received close to 280,000 applications from people all over the country. The 65,000 grants that we were able to make were people from all over the country. Of course, California, the Bay Area, San Francisco were the top places of our work, but we supported people in Texas and Florida, New York, Chicago. I mean, even in places where you wouldn't think are immigrants. So Yeah, but we were supporting people that live in Tennessee and people that live in Arkansas and so forth, right? I mean, everywhere, because people, again, people are being excluded at the national level. So, but what we did in San Mateo, however, was a little bit different, right? Because there we were approached by a philanthropist in San Mateo County that wanted to do more for people in San Mateo County. And this is John Sobrato. He reached out saying he wants to help. He wanted to figure out how to do that in an effective manner. And through the course of two or three conversations, John Sobrato was basically agreed to provide us with a $5 million grant, and knowing that 100% of that money was going to go directly to the people in San Mateo County. So that was the thing that we were able to sort of provide to or even guarantee to say, like, look, whatever money that you bring to the table, we guarantee you that 100% of that will go to the intended audience. Because at that moment in time, you know, we're not going to haggle over administrative fees or how much we're going to get paid. No, it's like that money is needed by people at the margins. And so for John, he was really, I can say, very surprised by that agreement, because he was like, what? You're not going to take an administrative fee? And I was like, I don't need it. Why do I want it? We already have it covered by other funders. So let's get money to the people. And so what he did in turn was, so he was so excited by that he actually turned around and helped us fundraise even more. So with his work, with his help, where he reached out to a lot of his colleagues, a lot of his fans, his network, we actually turned that $5 million into $16 million by the end of the campaign. And that was really, again, a lot of effort by John Sobrato and how he showed up. Because I was surprised by that, because normally funders, they just come in to say, I care about this issue. I care about the community. Here's a big check. And then they walk away and then they just ask for a report at the end of the year, right? And which is fine. I mean, we like those funders just as well. But I was surprised that John stood by us. He made calls. He sent letters. He showed up at meetings. I mean, he actually advocated and lobbied the county to match his money. And the county government actually did. And at the end of that, I mean, we had, I think, like half of the immigrant population in San Mateo County had applied for a grant through MAF. Half. And this was also another time, just to give you a sense of the magnitude of that work, right? Because, I mean, sometimes we don't even appreciate it. It's like, we just take an application, hit submit, and that's that. It's like, well, it's not, right? You have to take the information, you have to take the data, and then we have to figure out, well, how do we approve? Who do we approve? I mean, how do we make sense of all the data that was coming at us, right? And so we actually created what we call a financial equity framework to basically help us guide our decision-making process. Because what we did was, we rejected this idea that we had to approve applications on a first-come, first-served basis or based on this lottery system, right? Because we knew that those two approaches basically just deepens inequality. And particularly that lottery system, I think that's just sort of like a lazy way of policymaking, frankly, honestly. And this is, I know that's very common and very popular within politicians, because they don't want the responsibility of making choices. And so that means that we had to figure out, well, how do we assess the application? How do we assess the data that we were gathering through the applications themselves? And ultimately, we came up with a framework that looked at then the number of income lines or streamlines, income stream. We were able to sort of quantify the number of income streams. We were able to quantify the number of financial strains that were being impacting that particular family. And we were also able to quantify the number of barriers that people were facing, whether they're legal, whether they're foster kids, foster children or foster youth, or people that were documented or not documented. And so by looking at all those different sort of factors, we were able to sort of prioritize people based on that framework. And so as we fundraised, we supported people based on that, on those priorities. And then we were just sort of like the back-end administrators. Of course, we did a lot more than that, but that's how we were able to divide our work, making sure that they were always front and center if we're doing this work effectively.
And you reached over 16,000 people, I think, as well, something
yeah,
like that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. In San Mateo County, the grants were $1,000 per family. And at the national level, it was $500. And again, that was because of the philanthropists there. They knew that people needed more money. So we made that happen.
And staying with the kind of policy, if you will, and structure, it sounds like you've been able to use what you created in San Mateo County for the kind of scaling of the program on a national basis.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, in the rapid response, I mean, we were doing the work already at the national level. And then because of the money that we fundraised locally, we just went deeper in those localities, right? So the work happens nationally, but if LA County wanted us to do that, we could have done that in LA County just as well. And then we've always had that. I mean, with Lending Circles, that's how we expanded Lending Circles beyond the Mission District, which we had an approach of scaling that we call like a network approach to scaling, that by partnering with other organizations in different communities across the country, we were able to implement the program in their local communities. So we had that sort of like that muscle already built in, if you will. And so we did that in San Mateo County. We did that with folks in LA County. There we were working primarily with the creative community with support from the SNAP Foundation. So we made that happen. And now with this rapid response, I mean, this UBI program, we're doing even more so with the different cities. I mean, we just finished a contract with the city of Coachella that they want us to implement our UBI program in that locality. And so for us, it's like, it's kind of using the technology and the platform that we built, you know, having the capacity, having our ability to manage things in this virtual setting, like the way you heard from Efrain and Elena already. But then we can say, well, we can go deeper in different localities based on partnerships. So the city of Coachella, for example, they agreed to put $1 million from their city funds to provide UBI support for 140 of their families. So then we can come in and administer that financial component. And then in addition to, we can provide the financial training, the coaching, and self-advocacy that you heard from Elena earlier. And so that's sort of like the partnership. And that's how we're able to sort of go deeper in different localities across the country, no matter where.
Great. Wonderful. It's great to see it starting as a pebble in the pool in San Francisco and grow out across the country. I want to come to you, Efrain, to you work with folks on a one-on-one basis. And I have a feeling you have some really great stories and was hoping you could share with us a story of someone who came in through the coaching program and has been able to utilize the MAPS tools to change the trajectory of their financial life.
Yeah, I actually have a really good story about somebody who participated in one of our... So every month at MAF, we choose a theme for the month and all of our group finance events revolve around that theme. In the month of May, we had small business support because as Elena and Jose mentioned, our base is a very entrepreneurial base and they have big aspirations. And man, they're just very innovative in the way that they hustle, frankly. So I want to talk a little bit about one of our participants. His name is Jesus. So Jesus was working in a restaurant when the pandemic struck, and like many, he lost his job and he had to figure out exactly how he was going to maneuver and be able to provide for his family. He came to our community conversation and he shared his story because in the community conversation, it was a lot of people like him who are entrepreneurs who have their own small businesses and how he came about doing so. So what did he do? He actually started selling fruit. He became a fruit vendor. He got himself a cart. He started loading up on fruit and doing whatever he could to put money on the table. And it was just what I really, really appreciate about his story is one, his gratitude that he had for MAF because he was one of the recipients of our grant. And he's one of the participants in IFRP. So he receives that monthly funds and it's really helping him. But he also learned about our microloans for business. And he was able to use those funds that he's getting from us every single month to start a microloan and to buy a bigger cart and to buy more material that he is able to grow his business with. So because he realized that one, he could have gone back to the restaurant industry once things opened back up and relied on that source of income. But he also realized that he wanted to put matters in his own hands as much as possible. And I think that's one of the things that he learned throughout the pandemic is that unexpected things happen. And when unexpected things happen, you want to have as much control as possible. And I think that was something that was lacking for many of us, right? When the pandemic struck because of so much uncertainty, so much fear, and so much just unknowing about what's going to happen that a lot of us felt like we lost our sense of control. And that was definitely the case with Jesus.
Thank you. And staying with the idea of folks getting engaged, Elaine, I'm going to come to you and ask you to share with the audience how folks who are listening to the show can actually support MAF's work. Can they, besides being a donor, can they become mentors? Can they be volunteers? How can folks get engaged?
Thanks for that question. So I think the first thing I would say is learn more about us. Visit our website, sign up for our newsletter, follow us on social media. We actually just launched our own podcast, Cafe C. You can find that on our website as well. So we just really encourage you to be connected with us and learn more. If you're able to do so, you can consider making a financial donation. And if you're not, we just encourage you to connect and engage, even tune into a financial education event if that's something that would really be relevant for you.
Thank you. All right. So turning to our final question for everyone, and I'm going to start with you, Jose. Over the 2+ years of the pandemic, what do you feel have been some of, and I hate to use the term good, but some of the positive things that have perhaps come out of the catastrophe of the pandemic and now its financial impact on folks, especially with the financial increase of interest and all of the rest of it?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to consider. I think we're going to need 2.5 more years to try to discern everything that happened in the past 2.5 years, because we're still like in the middle of it, right? The pandemic hasn't gone away. I think one of the things that I realized that is that this has been one of those crises in people's lives, you know, that we all were able to pay attention to at the same time. But the reality of the people that we serve is that they live in multiple crises all of the time, whether it's because of their immigration status or because of their language or because of discrimination or because of them trying to reestablish themselves in a new country. I mean, they're in a perpetual state of crisis. We may not recognize it as such, right? Because we don't pay attention to it. But through the pandemic, we were forced to pay attention to that crisis that impacted us all. I think for MAF, this moment of this crisis really pushed us to be more virtual. And I think we're definitely heading in that direction. We had the technology, the processes, but this one definitely pushed us over in that direction. And thankfully, we have the staff, the capacity, and the vision to do that quickly, almost overnight. So that's actually, it's a good thing. I think definitely put us on the radar for funders at the national level in a way that we weren't in the past. So I think that's a good thing as well. I think the challenge is like, well, how do we maintain that? How do we retain that moving forward? And that's really going to be an ongoing conversation internally and also with our boards. Like, how do we maintain this position when it's difficult to do? But I think that's a welcome challenge. And one is, and also is how do you stay a national organization, but rooted in a community? And that's actually it's a challenge. It's not easy to do. And I haven't seen many examples or models of other entities that actually do that because it's hard. But that's something that we're grappling with as we speak.
Do you feel like over this last 2+ years, you've learned something more about yourself in going through the process?
I mean, again, this is what it's going to require a lifetime of discernment, right? But I go back to the moment when the issue came out about staying at home. You know, in that moment, we could have very easily, right? Elena, Efrain, you guys remember that? We could have easily said, okay, we'll stay at home. We'll do lending circles just like the way we always have and do nothing different. We could have done that, right? We could have just said, we have to close down shop and then just carry on. But we didn't do that. Instead, we said, here's a new challenge. Here's a new boulder is coming our way or coming the way of the people that we serve. How can we help? How do we show up? How do we do more for the people that we work with? And I don't know what to call that, but I wanted to note that because it could have been different, but it wasn't. And I'm so thankful that we didn't shy away from that challenge, right? Because we didn't shy away from it, we were able to transform ourselves in the ways that it was not in our annual business plan. I mean, it was not something that the board approved of right now. But that's what it means to do this work, is that there's a lot of uncertainty and we have to kind of roll with it, but with a hope and you know, faith that things are going to work out in the end. And I think for MAF, they have, and for the people that we serve, they have as well.
Thank you. And coming to you, Elena, what do you feel are some of the positive good things that have come out of the pandemic?
So to me, I think one of the big positives that I really hope that we can all continue to carry with us is that the pandemic really forced us to look inward and engage with our local community, engage neighbor to neighbor. At a time when we were all trapped in the four walls of our home and so many people were experiencing just this deep sense of isolation and frankly, loneliness. We heard that from a lot of our clients. A lot of them felt very lonely. I think the positive that grew out of that is there were so many stories we heard of neighbors helping neighbors, people building community and relying on that community so heavily in the darkest days, in those scariest and most uncertain moments, and thinking to a hypothetical future when we have moved on, whatever that means from this pandemic. I really hope that that's something that we keep with us, those close connections, be they your next door neighbor or new connections that formed completely online. But I think however that shows up, that sense of community engagement and really showing up for your neighbors is something that I hope we can carry with us.
Thank you. And finally, turning to you, Efrain, what are some of the positive or good things that have come out of the pandemic that you feel have helped empower community members financially?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Off top of mind, I can think of two things. One, it's like it sparked an already burning flame of curiosity in financial education. I think people were put in a really tough spot, right? And maybe this tough spot had people saying, hey, I need to learn more about this. I need to prepare myself in case something like this were to happen again. What's the best thing that I can do in my situation to pad that? Because this came out of nowhere. Right. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a financial educator. I'm saying that because I grew up poor in an immigrant family. And I know the impact that having proper financial education and just knowing about resources and the impact that can have on the trajectory of somebody's life, especially when navigating through something as severe as a pandemic. So I think for what it's worth, I think people became even more resilient. We weathered the storm. And the next time that a storm comes, I'm sure we're going to remember this one. And we're going to say, hey, this is how we maneuvered last time. This is how we can adjust to this time. So those are things that I think, good things that came from the pandemic.
Thank you. I want to thank Jose, Elena, and Efrain for sharing the work of Mission Asset Fund and its financial impact on immigrants and families in our community. We'll make sure that listeners have your contact information, website, and social media so they can follow Mission Asset Fund and get engaged in your work as well as support the work, hopefully by donations. Please stay safe and healthy as we all work our way through the latest surge of COVID-19, which never seems to go away. And we wish you all the best in successfully scaling up the Immigrant Families Recovery Program. That's it for this episode of Voices of the Community. You've been listening to the voices of the co-founder and CEO, Jose Quinones, along with the Director of Programs, Elena Fairley, and the Manager of Financial Education and Engagement, Efrain Segundo, from the Mission Asset Fund. We hope that you found our interview with the Mission Asset Fund team helpful in better understanding how the consequences of being unbanked have on our fellow community members' lives and our overall economy. It costs them more money to just cash their paychecks, pay rent, and their bills because they don't have access to financial services other than the predatory financial services of check cashing and money orders. To find out more about the Mission Asset Fund's services and to support their work that provides financial services to thousands of unbanked families and micro-enterprises in our community, please go to missionassetfund.org. We hope that you enjoyed the insights, points of view, and personal stories from the voices of changemakers and their nonprofits and small businesses featured in this series. To find out more and get engaged with the nonprofits, small businesses, and staff members featured in the series, please go to my website, georgecoster.com, and click on Voices of the Community to find links to the extended versions of these interviews and to listen to the entire series. After listening to these stories, we hope that you will consider making a donation and volunteering to provide a hand up to your fellow community members. Today's episode was made possible by the audio wizard and our associate producer, Eric Estrada, and the graphics magic of Casey Nance from Citron Studios, along with the wonderful crew at the San Francisco Public Press and KSFP. Voices of the Community is supported by a grant from the James Irvine Foundation, dedicated to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. More at irvine.org. Voices of the Community is a member of Intersection for the Arts, which allows us to offer you a tax deduction for your contributions. Please go to georgecoster.com and click on the donate link to make a donation to help us provide future shows just like this one. While you're on our website, you can enjoy our archived past shows, which feature community voices working on solutions to critical issues facing Northern California communities. And you can sign up for our newsletter to find out more about future shows, as well as shows and events from the organizations that are included in our episodes. Take us along on your next COVID walk by subscribing to Voices of the Community on Apple Podcasts,
Spotify, and Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at George Koster, and we'd love to hear from you with feedback and show ideas, so send us an email to george@georgekoster.com. I'm George Koster in San Francisco, and thank you for listening.